we present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Have His Carcass by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton, with Mariah Aitken as Harriet Vane and Nigel Stock as Inspector Umplety. Episode 2. Lord Peter Sets a Trap.
When Harriet Vane's walking tour along the south coast of England was interrupted by the discovery of a body on the beach, she at first assumed that she had encountered merely the dullest kind of suicide. It was not, she reflected, nearly so complicated and interesting a problem as any of the situations she so successfully described in her best-selling detective novels. Thus it was, with a certain diffidence, that Harriet pursued her inquiries in the little town of Wilverghem, while Lord Peter returned to London in an attempt to trace the origin of the razor found beside the body. Having established that the victim had been making plans to marry one Mrs. Weldon, a lady both older and richer than her betrothed, Harriet resolved to find out whether the professional dancers of the largest and grandest local hotel could cast any light on the last days of the unfortunate Paul Alexis. And that is why, on the evening following her discovery of the corpse, Miss Harriet Vane was to be seen swaying round the dance lounge of the Hotel Resplendent in the competent professional arms of a dark-haired gigolo, known to one and all as Monsieur Antoine.
I'm afraid, Monsieur Antoine, that I'm not a very good dancer.
You dance very correctly, mademoiselle. It is only the entrain that is a little lacking. It is possible that you are awaiting the perfect partner. When the heart dances with the feet, then it will be à merveille.
Is that the kind of thing you have to say to all these old ladies?
I am afraid so. That is part of our job, you know, Miss Vane.
It must be very tedious.
Que voulez-vous? All work has its tedious moments, which are repaid by those that are more agreeable.
There's something I wanted to ask you, Monsieur Antoine. Tell me about Mr. Alexis.
Poor Alexis. It was Mademoiselle who found him, I understand.
Yes. I had heard that he was engaged to be married.
Oh, yes. To the English lady, Mrs. Weldon. That was understood.
Was he happy about it?
Mademoiselle, Alexis was poor and the English lady is very rich. It was advantageous to him to marry her. At first, no doubt, it might offer a little désagrément, but afterwards, you understand, mademoiselle, these matters arrange themselves.
You don't think that he suddenly felt he couldn't face it and took this way out?
That is difficult to say, but no, I do not think so. He had, after all, only to go away. He was a very good dancer and very popular. He would easily have found another situation, provided his health would permit him to continue.
It all seems to me rather odd that he should have done away with himself like that.
Thank you, mademoiselle.
What is the arrangement now? Do we go on dancing, or have you other engagements?
There is no reason why we should not continue for the next dance. After that, unless mademoiselle wishes to make a special arrangement, I have to attend to my other patrons.
No, I don't want to upset things. Is there any reason why you and the two young ladies who work here should not have a little supper with me later on?
None at all. It is very kind, very amiable. There is a small restaurant only a few streets from here. We can be private there and speak quite freely. I will arrange it all. It is natural that mademoiselle should take an interest.
And then, you see, of course, Alexis had a girl as well.
Oh, did he? Tell me about her, Doris.
Well, Caris knows more about it than me, really, don't you, Caris?
No, I don't. It was you Alexis shared all his secrets with.
Well, he did have a girl, but they broke it off a few weeks ago.
I see. Was Alexis very upset?
Oh, no. Seemed rather pleased about it, in fact, didn't he, Antoine?
It is true. He seemed relieved.
If you ask me, Alexis wanted her out of the way so he could get on with his other little plans.
What other little plans?
I'm sure I don't know.
But he had something up his sleeve these last few weeks. Very grand about it, he was. You'll see, he said. Just you wait a little bit. Well, I'm sure, I said. I have no wish to intrude. You can keep your secrets, I said, for I don't want to know them.
All this rubbish about his noble birth and fallen fortunes. You think he did the floor a favour by dancing on it?
Oh, come on, Caris. He wasn't so bad as all that. Anyhow, he's dead, poor boy. And you oughtn't to run him down.
Why is he dead? One does not cut one's throat pour s'amuser.
That's another thing I can't make out. He hadn't the nerve to do a thing like that. Why, he was terrified of pricking his little finger. You needn't frown like that, Doris. Alexis was a regular namby-pamby, and you know it. You used to laugh at him yourself. I cannot climb that step ladder. I am afraid to fall. I am afraid to go to the dentist. He might pull my teeth out. Really, Mr. Alexis, I used to say to him, anyone would think you was made of glass.
And he'd have taken some sleeping stuff if he really wanted to do it. But cutting his throat with a razor, no, he'd never do that.
That's awfully interesting. By the way, did he have anything the matter with his skin? I mean, did he always have to wear gloves or anything of that sort?
Oh, no. The gigolo must not have things the matter with his skin. That would not do at all.
He said his skin was sensitive, and that's why he didn't shave.
Did Alexis have a razor at all?
I cannot tell. Do you know Doris?
Me? I like that. Alexis wasn't my fancy man, you know. I'll ask Layla Garland. She ought to know.
His mistress. Yes, ask her, Doris. That is of importance. I have not thought of that. Mon Dieu.
You've told me a lot of interesting things. I'm very much obliged to you. And I'd be still more obliged if you didn't mention that I'd been asking you.
Listen, mademoiselle. We know how to be discreet. Ma foi, if we did not, we should not keep our jobs, you understand. We have eyes and ears, mademoiselle, but we say nothing. It is our business to say nothing.
A perfectly splendid day for exploring beaches. Perhaps a trifle on the blowy side, but let's not complain.
Peter, I shall certainly start to complain very loudly unless you immediately tell me what you found out about the razor.
The razor? Oh, the razor. Well, I tracked down old Endicott without too much difficulty. His hairdressing salon in Jermyn Street is now sadly reduced to a ham shop. Though I do believe they do a rather good line in Gentleman's Special Pickle. I found the old boy living in healthy retirement in Ealing. Fortunately, he still has a memory like an encyclopedia, and he actually recalls selling one of his splendid razors to Colonel Belfridge, who was forever bringing his razor back to Endicott to be reset. Seems the Colonel took the edge off with the strop instead of putting it on.
And you found the Colonel?
I did. Endicott still had his address. The good Colonel proved to be a rather cantankerous old fellow. However, he eventually informed me that he had given away his pair of razors to the gardener.
Who no longer worked for him.
On the contrary. I interviewed the gardener, who had wisely passed on the maltreated razors to his brother-in-law, who lives in Seahampton.
Seahampton? But that's less than 50 miles from here.
Precisely.
Didn't you ask this gardener if either of the razors had a crack in the ivory handle?
I did. One of them had been dropped on the stone floor of the cottage, which had left a slight crack in the handle.
So did you go to Seahampton?
Yes, and I found the brother-in-law, who is a hairdresser. He still had one of the razors, the one without the crack.
And what happened to the other one?
He'd sold it to an itinerant hairdresser who'd come to him looking for work.
Recently?
Barely a few weeks ago. A man by the name of Bright, described by our hairdresser as a little rat of a fellow, sandy-haired and too smooth by half. Oh, yes, and he had one shoulder higher than the other.
Peter, that's wonderful. All we have to do is find this Mr. Bright. I mean, surely there can't be two white Endicott razors bearing the same evidence of misuse and with the same small crack in the ivory.
It's probably the right razor.
A tramp barber with sandy hair and a crooked shoulder ought not to be so very difficult to find.
There's always the disagreeable possibility that Mr. Bright was a barber for that one performance only. In which case, his name is certainly not Bright. Well, here we are. Let us continue our discussion at the scene of the crime.
We can get down to the beach from that path over there. There's the rock where I found the body. The Devil's Flatiron.
Right. Now, the thing we want to get is the time of the death.
Well, the police are quite clear about how Alexis came here, and there doesn't seem to be any doubt in the matter, which is a blessing. There's a train from Wilvercombe that stops at Darley Halt on Thursdays at 10:15 to take people into Heathbury Market. Alexis travelled by that train and got out at the halt. He was pretty conspicuous with his black beard and his natty gent's outfitting.
Witnesses?
Yes, lots.
Uh-huh.
The guard on the train, three or four of his fellow travellers, and the booking clerk remembers him at Wilvercombe. And there's a first-class return ticket from Wilvercombe to Darley Halt that was never given up and never accounted for.
A return ticket? Well, that seems to knock the suicide theory on the head.
Well, one wouldn't make an intending suicide take a return ticket in a book, but real people are different.
Let us merely note the return half of the ticket as something that needs explaining. Now, if the train gets into Darley Halt at 10:15, and allowing Alexis the moderate pace of 3 miles an hour, then he can't have got to the Flatiron later than, say, 11:45.
Stop a minute. How about the tide? When was low water on Thursday?
At 1:15. I've been into all that. At 11:45, or very shortly after, our friend could have walked out dryshod and sat on it.
Good. We know he did go out dryshod, so that all fits in nicely. What next?
Well, what? Whether he cut his own throat or whether somebody cut it for him, when did he die? Ah, it's an awful pity we've lost the body. Even if it turns up, it won't tell us a thing. It wasn't stiff, of course, when you saw it, and you say you can't tell if it was cold.
If there'd been a block of ice on that rock at the time, you could have boiled eggs on it.
Tiresome, tiresome. Now, wait a minute. The blood. Now, how about that? Did you notice whether it was a sort of jelly of white serum with the red part at the bottom or anything?
It wasn't. It was liquid.
It was what?
Liquid. When I put my hand into it, it was quite wet.
Great Scott! Was it in a hollow on the rock? I mean, could it have been mixed with seawater?
No, listen, it was quite liquid everywhere. It dripped out of his neck, and when I tried to take his glove off, the leather wasn't stiff, it was soft and wet. His hand had been lying right under his throat.
Good Lord, but...
That was the left hand. The right hand was...
Yes, 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 I know. That doesn't matter now. It's the blood. Do you realize that if the blood was still liquid, he can only have been dead a few minutes?
Oh, what a fool I am. I ought to have known that. And I thought I was deducing things so nicely. He couldn't have been bleeding slowly to death for some time, I suppose.
With his throat cut to the neck bone? Dear child, pull yourself together. Now, look here. Blood clots very quickly. More quickly, of course, on a cold surface. In the ordinary way, it'll clot almost instantaneously on exposure to the air. I dare say it might take a little longer on a hot surface, like the rock you described so graphically, but it couldn't take more than a few minutes. Say 10, to give it an outside limit.
10 minutes?
Hmm.
Oh, Peter... That noise that woke me up. I thought it was a seagull's cry. They sound so human, but suppose it was...
It must have been. When was that?
2 o'clock. I looked at my watch. And I shouldn't think it took me more than 10 minutes to reach the rock, but... I say...
Hmm?
Well, how about your murder theory? That's done it in absolutely. If Alexis was murdered at 2 o'clock and I was there 10 minutes after, what became of the murderer?
Oh, hell. Harriet, dear, sweet, beautiful Harriet, say you were mistaken. We can't be wrong about the murder. I've staked my reputation with Inspector Umpletee that it couldn't have been suicide. Say that the blood was clotted. Or say at least that there were footprints you overlooked. What about the boat you saw?
Well, there was a boat, but it wasn't within hail because I hailed it.
What do you mean, not within hail because you hailed it? If the murderer was in the boat, naturally he wouldn't have put back if it had hailed sweet potatoes. What sort of a boat was it?
Well... Frankly, one sailing boat to me is much like any other.
Yeah, well, never mind. We'll be able to trace it. I only wanted to know what sort of draft the boat was likely to have. You see, if the boat couldn't come right into the rock, the fellow would have had to row himself in or swim for it. And that would have delayed him a good bit.
Oh, Peter, a very unpleasant thought has just struck me.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think the murderer could have been there, quite close, all the time, swimming underwater or something?
He'd have to come up to breathe.
Yes, but I might not have noticed him.
It's a nasty thought. I wonder if there's any cleft in the Flatiron where he might have hidden himself. I say, I'm going down to have a look at it. Turn your modest eyes seaward till I've climbed into a bathing suit. You do the same. We shall explore the Flatiron and see what it has to tell us.
Water's damn chilly.
Icy, I'd say.
Where were you? On this side?
On the other. Uh-huh. I looked down on both sides of me, though.
Yeah. Well, climb up on the rock, the spot where you were standing.
All right.
You didn't look down in this direction by any chance, did you?
No, I don't think so. I came round in that direction and groped about under the rock.
Uh-huh.
There were about 18 inches of water. And that's the spot where I found the razor.
Here?
No. There.
There?
Yes.
Ah. Well, there are about 5 feet of water now, I should think. Can you see me from where you're standing?
No. There's a bulge in the rock.
Well, I'm standing in a little niche. It's about the size of a coffin. Beautifully screened from all sides except the sea.
How horrible. The man must have been in there all the time.
Well, I think he's more plausible than the boat idea. Mind you, it's a trifle cramped in here. Can't be all right if you're not too vulgar big.
Bright.
I'm glad you think so.
I mean, Bright. The man who bought the razor. Didn't the hairdresser say you were small?
So he did, Bijo. One up to you. I wonder... Oh, I say, I found something. Look, come down and have a look at this.
What is it?
Well, it's a ring. Sort of thing you tie boats up to. Driven right into the rock.
Where?
Well, it's underwater. It feels smooth and new, not corroded. Does that help your boat theory at all, I wonder?
I don't know. I'm getting cold. Let's swim about a bit and then get dressed and discuss it.
Right.
Look here. If you were a murderer and you saw an interfering woman pottering about among the evidence and then going off in search of help, what would you do?
Leg it in the opposite direction.
Then you think that when I'd gone, the murderer just totted off home to Leston Hole?
Unless he went along the main road to Wolvercombe and then doubled back again so as to pretend that he'd just come from Wolvercombe.
Then I'd have met him.
Well, suppose you did.
But, oh, yes.
Mr. What's his name from London? Your spineless hiker.
Perkins. Yes, I wonder. Could anybody be genuinely as foolish as Perkins appeared? He was a rat of a man, too, quite small, and he was sandy-haired. And you know, I do think it was awfully funny the way Perkins just evaporated when I got to the village shop to phone the police. Good Lord. Fancy me meekly trotting along for a mile and a half, hand in hand with a murderer.
Juicy. Very juicy. We'll have to look more carefully into Mr. Perkins. Can that name be real? It seems almost too suitable. According to the police, Perkins hired a car in the village and got himself driven to Wolvercombe railway station. He is thought to have taken a train to somewhere, but the place was full of trampers and trippers that day, and so far they haven't traced him further. I adore the thought of Bright being Perkins. I say, though, how about this lopsided hunchback business? Was Perkins upright as a willow wand, or how?
Not by any means. But I shouldn't have called him actually crooked, more sloppy and round-shouldered. He had a rucksack on his back, and he was walking a bit lame, as if he had a blister on his foot.
Well, that would be a good way of disguising any one-sidedness in his appearance. You're always apt to hunch up a bit on the lame side. Bright Perkins is our man. We ought to get the police onto this right away.
And that, Inspector, is why Bright or Perkins must be found without delay.
You may say what you like, my lord, but to my mind, it was suicide for all that. And if I was a sporting man, I wouldn't mind having a bit on it. There's no harm done by tracing this fellow Bright, because if the identification of the razor is correct, that's who this Alexis must have bought it from. But there's no doubt in my mind that when the poor chap left his lodgings on Thursday, he never meant to come back. You've only got to look at the place. Everything tidied away, bills all paid up, papers burnt in the grate. You might say he'd regular said goodbye and kissed his hand to everything.
No hope of recovering anything from the ashes?
No, he must have torn everything into small scraps first, and then beaten the ashes into atoms with the poker.
Any books or anything with writing in the fly leaves?
Just a few novels with Paul Alexis inside, and some with nothing at all. And one or two paperback books written in Chinese.
Chinese?
Well, it looked like it. Russian, maybe. Not in proper letters, anyhow. One or two history books there was, too, mostly about Russia.
Any money?
No.
Had he a banking account?
Yes, he had a small account with Lloyd's. Matter of little over £300. But he drew the old lot out 3 weeks ago.
Did he, Major? Whatever for? Wouldn't cost him all that to buy a razor. Something else, Inspector.
Hmm?
Suppose a fishing boat had wanted to come in at the Flatiron just about low tide on Thursday. Could she do it?
Oh, easy, my lord. Some of these boats don't draw more than a foot of water. You could bring her in beautifully, provided you kept clear of the grinders and remembered to reckon with the current.
A stranger might get into difficulties, what?
He might, but not if he was a good seaman. We've been trying to get a line on that boat you saw, Miss Vane. I got an idea it might have been one of the Pollocks. But they're a surly lot, the Pollocks. It won't be easy to get any useful information out of them.
At any rate, Inspector, I think we've got the actual time of the death pretty well fixed by now. That ought to help.
Yes, my lord, but I think we're going to find that this murder stuff is clean impossible. You see, we haven't been idle either. Anyone travelling along the road between Wilbercombe and Leicester Knowe has got to go through the level crossing gates near Darley. We've checked with the keeper there and investigated the bona fides of every traveller that day. And I'm quite ready to vouch for any of them, personally.
What about the fellow I spoke to, who was camping out along there, just beyond Darley Hall?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't laid hands on that particular gentleman, though we've got inquiries out after him. He packed up and departed early on Friday morning, taking his belongings in a Morgan. He'd been camping at the bottom of Inks Lane since Tuesday, and has the name of Aveland Martin.
Is that so? And he disappeared immediately after the crime. Isn't that a trifle suspicious?
Not a bit. He was having his lunch at the Three Feathers in Darley at 1 o'clock, and he didn't leave till 1:30. Nobody in a Morgan passed through the level crossing that day, so he'd have had to walk along the shore. If the time of the death was 2 o'clock, then, well, you tell me how a man could walk 4.5 miles in half an hour, and I'll get a warrant made out for Mr. Martin's arrest.
Your trick, Inspector.
Thank you. Well, in any case, Mr. Martin isn't much good to us, because he spent Thursday morning in Wilvercombe, or so he mentioned to the landlord of the Feathers.
What a pity. Did anybody notice the number of his Morgan?
Yes. It belongs to a London garage, where they hire out cars to be driven by the IRA. Mr. Martin came in there last Thursday week, paid his deposit in case, and returned the bus on Sunday night. He said that he'd given up his house and had no fixed address, but gave a reference to a Cambridge banker.
How about the bank?
Oh, that's all right. Mr. Aveland Martin has been a depositor there for 5 years. Introduced by another client. No irregularity.
All the same, I'd like to have a chat with him. There are points about him which seem to be suggestive, as Sherlock Holmes would say.
Well, I'd feel more enthusiastic about this investigation, my lord, if I had any sort of proof that there really was a murder committed. Just at present, it's a bit thin, you'll allow.
If it is a case of murder, it's been so neatly worked out, there doesn't seem to be much of a loophole in it.
Unless it's the razor. Look here, Inspector. I've got an idea about the razor.
Yes, my lord.
I think I'll have a word with Salcombe Hardy. He's still down here covering the case for the Gazette. Our one hope now is to tempt the murderer, if there is one, into making a mistake by trying to be too clever. Yes, I think that's worth a try.
And I think you're treating me damn badly, old man.
I wouldn't say that, Sally.
I'm the last pressman to still be following this case. I know you must have something up your sleeve, or you wouldn't be hanging around the scene of the crime like this. Unless it's the girl. If there's nothing else doing, give me a story about the girl. Anything will do, as long as it's a story. Romantic engagement of Pierce's son. That's better than nothing.
Now, pull yourself together, Sally, and keep your inky paws out of my private affairs. Anyway, I'm going to give you a nice, pretty story all to yourself. Now then, take this down. The mystery surrounding the horrible tragedy at the Flatiron deepens steadily with every effort to solve it. Far from being a simple case of suicide, as at first seemed probable, the horrible death...
All right, I can do that part on my own. What I want is the story.
Yes, but work up the mystery part of it. Go on, now. Lord Peter Wimsey, the celebrated amateur of crime detection, interviewed by our special correspondent in his pleasant sitting room at the Hotel Bellevue.
Is the sitting room important?
The address is. I want them to know where to find me.
Right you are. Go ahead.
At the Hotel Bellevue, Wilvercombe, said that while the police still held strongly to the suicide theory, he himself was by no means satisfied. The point that particularly troubled him was that whereas the deceased wore a full beard and had never been known to shave, the crime...
Crime?
Suicide is a crime.
So it is. Well?
Was committed with an ordinary cutthroat razor which shows signs of considerable previous hard wear. Now, rub that in well, Sally. The history of this razor has been traced up to a point.
Who traced it?
I did.
Can I say that?
If you like.
Well, that makes it better. Lord Peter Wimsey explained, with his characteristically modest smile, that he had himself been at pains to trace the previous history of the razor, a search which led him... Where did it lead you, Wimsey?
I don't want to tell him that. Say that the search covered many hundreds of miles.
All right, I can make that sound very important. Anything else?
Yes, now this is the important bit. Get him to put it in black lettering, you know.
Not my business, sub-editor. But I'll try. To continue, leaning over the table and emphasizing the point with an eloquent gesture of his artistic hand, Lord Peter said...
The trail breaks off at the crucial point. How did the razor get into the hands of Paul Alexis? If I could be satisfied at that, the answer might at once set at rest all my doubts. If Paul Alexis can be proved to have bought the razor, I shall consider the suicide theory to have been proved up to the hilt. But until that missing link in the chain of evidence is reconstructed, I shall hold that Paul Alexis was foully and brutally murdered, and I shall spare no efforts to bring the murderer to the judgment he has so richly deserved. There. How's that, Sally?
Not too bad. I can work that up into something.
Oh, thank you.
I might even get them to offer a reward.
No, why not? Anyway, pitch it to them hot and strong.
I will. For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. Between you and me, Wimsey, would you be satisfied that it was suicide if the reward was claimed?
Probably not. In fact, I am never satisfied. Just publish, Sally, publish. Reveal all in your rag, and we shall see who, if anyone, comes forward.
In that episode of Have His Carcass, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael, Harriet Vane, Mariah Aitken, Inspector Umpleby, Nigel Stock, Antoine, Malcolm Ingram, Salcom Hardy, Patrick Newell, Doris, Carol Harrison, Caris, Deirdre Costello, narrator, John Westbrook. Have His Carcass was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers, and was produced by Martin Fisher.